So we spent last week setting a context in which we could understand how Sri Aurobindo approached the promulgation of the life divine in the context of the philosophic journal Arya, which he launched this month in 1914, 100 years ago. We looked at his spiritual experiences. More than that, at the profound realizations that were deep set in him long before he came to Pondicherry. Because he began with the Vedantic realization of that unnameable vastness, that blowing out of the world into a Brahmic Nirvana, as the Gita would call it. But he proceeded from that to an enlarging positive experience of the divine stationed everywhere in all things, and not simply as an abstract existence, but as a person who took a central position in the midst of all becoming and in the midst of each being within that becoming. So there was a mighty synthesis before he arrived in Pondicherry between these two different states, the static and the dynamic, the transcendent and the universal. And when he got there, arrived in Pondicherry, which became his cave of tapasya, he began to keep a detailed record of the movement of the sadhana, because the twin powers of that realization sitting in him made him realize that the way that the Vedantic truths have been interpreted in recent centuries is missing something, missing an answer to life. We find in Sri Aurobindo this profound basis of realization, multi-realization. We also find in him a deep interest, a growing interest in the spiritual traditions of India, because now that he's got these experiences, he wants to understand better and better what has been conveyed from generation to generation over the millenniums. There is also a third thing to remember, and that is that Sri Aurobindo intellectually is gifted, to say the least. Ingenious. He could be absorptive, analytical, open to fresh ideas, and ultimately synthetic in all fields. This is not syncretism. This is not simply taking materia gathered from every tradition, hauling it into a room and assembling it in some way that makes a kind of order from it. No, it is from the reverse thing, that inwardly his experience, his realization became vaster and vaster and included more and more of what he found around him in teachings, in schools of philosophy. And when he came to look at some of the greatest figures in Indian thinking. He found ultimately that though they represented a truth and something certifiably valuable, that they did not go far enough. So when, say from around 1912, he begins keeping a notebook which he calls The Life Divine, and it's really a study of the Isha Upanishad, because there many things are dealt with and answered in the short compass of 18 verses. He writes almost a paragraph of apology, and I think it's worth reading that to you if I can find it. And I'll break into the middle of a paragraph if you don't mind. He says, "What is it that the Upanishad reveals? This is the question I have set myself to answer. I am indifferent for what set of warring philosophical dogmas its texts can be made an armory. Nevertheless, in the course of exegesis, I have been compelled to come into conflict with the opinions of the Mayavada. The collision was inevitable rather than desired, for the Mayavada was the opinion with which I commenced my study of Vedanta. It is a system which still attracts the abstract intellectuality in me and represents to me what I may call an intervening and mediary truth of realization, which can never lose its validity. But when it seeks to govern human thought and life, to perpetuate itself as the sole truth of Vedanta, I feel that it is in conflict with the old Vedanta, stultifies the Upanishad, and endangers or sterilizes all our highest human activities without giving us the highest spiritual truth in its place. Even so, I would have preferred to leave aside all negative criticism of it in these commentaries, but that is not possible, for it has so possessed India's ideas about the Upanishads that it has to be cleared away in order that the true sense of this Upanishad at least may shine out from the obscuration. For the Isha, at least, does not support the Mayavada, as is indeed evident from the struggle and sense of difficulty in Shankara's own commentary, which reduces its fine thought and admirable expression to incoherence and slipshod clumsiness. The error, however lofty, must be removed in order that the plain and simple truth may reveal itself." I'll stop there, but you get a sense. Now, these commentaries that he's referring to here were never published. This turned out to have been a notebook, one of maybe three notebooks in which he took up the issue of Upanishad and dwelt upon it, treating all kinds of philosophic issues that arise in those 18 verses. Eventually, he would write an extraordinary commentary, which was published alongside The Life Divine in the Arya, because they separated. The Life Divine became his magnum opus, the spear point, you might say, of his philosophic vision as it moved forward through the pages of the Arya. And the commentary in the issue Upanishad was simply that, to bring out the meaning of it. But you can see why this would be the basis and the thing that really resonated with him as he begins his sadhana and his philosophic explorations in Pondicherry. Because in those verses, and we won't go through them all, but let's just think about them for a bit. The first thing is the asseveration that all this is for the habitation of the Lord. I love the way he translates that. To me, it makes great sense, just like that. In other words, the divine is inside all of this, just like inside a garment. This goes to a modern term in the last 30 years or so, 40 years, maybe it's 50 years now. We have started to prefer a term in philosophy and religion, panentheism, over the term pantheism. Pantheism means that this world is God. Everything you see is God. But panentheism means that God dwells inside the universe, so they're not exactly equated. The universe may draw its being from the divine, and the divine may indwell it, but they are not identical because there's something in that divinity which transcends, which is above and beyond what we can touch, what we can see, what we can think about. Transcends means beyond that line. And beyond that line, well, the Ishu Upanishad says it's not just a featureless blank existence, it is the Lord, Isha. Isha, it's a person, it's a being who has deliberately established itself, himself, herself, whatever it might be, that person is here. And that has consequences for us. It is true of us too. We are persons. Maybe we are not gigantic like the divine person is, but we also are living in a world of our own. And we are the center of our world, just as the divine is the center of the great world. And just as we are the center of our world, the divine is the center of us. Let's not dwell too much on the spatiality of this idea, but the concept immediately grasps us, doesn't it? It's something that grips you when you hear it. This universe, big and small, has the divine at its core. And if it's like that in our growing spiritual experience, it means that the world is real. God, the transcendent, is not opposed to God, the universal. And God, the individual, is not opposed to the transcendent or the universal. But what about that individual? How is he supposed to live in the world? This is a practical question. Spiritual experience is fine when you're in the experience, but when you come back to deal with the world, which is a positive expression of the Godhead, you have to awake to the world. What do you do? You don't live the same way you lived before. You don't desire the same things, and yet you act. The suggestion that the Ishu Upanishad brings to us is that you do continue to act in the world by renouncing or surrendering yourself, your little self, by stepping out of egoistic claim. You are released. What acts in and through you without obscuration can be the divine force when the surrender is complete. And when it is complete, you enjoy. There is no harm in enjoyment. That is indeed the Upanishad's statement. Live 100 years. You should aspire to live the fullness of life for 100 years, not confined to the ego. If you've come to the spiritual life you're ready enough to step outside of the ego and live more largely in the divine reality. That reality is not canceling out the phenomena of the universe. Existence does not wash out the movement of the world, but underlies it and lives in it. So, the Upanishad says, that divine, moving or unmoving, is the same reality. The gods can chase it, but that Isha, that Lord, is already there. Because it pre-exists, it already is. It's faster than thought, more powerful than the life force.
Able to leave.
I know where you're going. So, the world affirmation of the Isha is fixed upon this idea of discovering the divine behind all the antinomies and appearances of life. Opposites that the Isha Upanishad presents to us are reconcilable in the larger reality, the eternal and time, the small and the large, the light and the dark. And it refuses to allow us to sink into one posture of spirituality to the exclusion of others. Remember how it speaks to us about the darkness of the one who seeks the spirit only, as if fallen into a greater darkness by refusing to look at the world. If you're engaged in the world, living in the ignorance, you may be ignorant. But when you discover the divine, you don't discover it just outside the world. That's a greater darkness than simply being ignorant, because you've missed the whole point of the cosmic manifestation. To get that, you have to realize the transcendent and the universal, and to find its presence in you. You have to do this. This is your job. This is your mission as a spiritual aspirant. This is your mission as a soul spark entering into the universe, coming out of that great fire. Until you have done that, you have not exhausted all that's possible to you. You may at some point say, "Finis, I'm quitting. This is enough. I've enjoyed the ride and now I'm stepping out." Well, if you can do that, well and good. But does your deepest soul accept that? So this Upanishad, the Isha, closes, as you'll remember, by calling us to remember the deed, that which was done. Remember what was done. In other words, as we get ready to exit this life, and we've gathered all of this richness into us, we really do offer ourselves in a kind of sacrifice. We make a final gift of the whole of the sap of our existence, all that we accomplished in life. We give to the divine at the close and ask that power of aspiration, that power of purity and progress in us, which the Veda called Agni, to carry us upwards. Ashes remain behind. It all goes to dust. All the forms, the names melt away. But this thing which is eternal in you does not melt away. That thing is fixed in the divine. But the richness of life, the richness of that realization, which affirmed the world, may call the victorious soul back to the world. And so again and again we come, even after realization, to seek joy, to seek light, to seek experience in this world. Now, the issue of Upanishad, we'll remember from when we looked at it some months ago, is probably a text from the Videha region of India. So it's not in the northwest or in the Kuru Panchala area where the Vedic culture began in India and was most strongly broadcast. The Isha seems to arise in that area of India where Jainism and Buddhism came from. Two renunciant paths which rejected the world. And of course, later, Advaita Vedanta also rejected it. But this is the only Upanishad that is actually part of a Vedic Samhita. It's one of the few that's in verse. It's not a very early Upanishad, but clearly so important because of how it brought all things together into one compass. It's just natural that Sri Aurobindo would take this as the basis of his work. Of course, he mentioned that the Taittiriya is an Upanishad that he wished he'd had time to write extensively about because of its insistence on ananda, delight, as being the reason and the purpose behind the world. But the main philosophic point that had to be made to marry his experience to the Indian tradition was to say that, yes, the world is real and our lives are valuable, and what we do with ourselves and how fully we evolve has an impact not only upon our own personal transformation, but can lead to a larger social transformation, a rebirth of a country, a remaking of a world. All of this flows out of the idea that the spiritual personality, if he will take his realization, the illumination, the radiance, the joy, the power that come from them, and pour those realizations back into the world with the idea of seva, that it is a gift and service to the divine, that the world can be remade, this idea of a forward march, an evolution of consciousness into greater light and greater delight, is core to Sri Aurobindo's vision. So we'll see that he not only calls upon the issue of Upanishad often in the mottos which begin the chapters of the Life Divine. There are citations from the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Gita, etc., which he called mottos, which open each chapter. We will find them sprinkled throughout from the Isha Upanishad as well. But this theme of the consonance between the spirit and matter, you know, it's there at the very beginning of the life divine. And next week, I want to show you physically some copies of the Aria and the Life Divine in its original published form as a book, moving from journal to book, so that you can have a sense of what its history is. We've tried to pour foundation over these last months from March till now to get us ready to read the Life Divine. We've wandered sometimes, but we also have strode through deliberately some difficult terrain. And now we're ready to start. So a week from today, on the 17th of August, we'll take up our first chapter of the Life Divine. The first article saw publication on Sri Aurobindo's birthday on the 15th of August, 1914, in both an English and a French edition in the journal Arya. And it will interest you to know, as we go through it, how he interpreted that term, what he meant when he titled the journal Arya. The first chapter was written only as early as perhaps June of 1914 and then sent to the press. He had some early efforts towards this first expository chapter, which he was not satisfied with. And then finally, a kind of afflatus arrived from above, and he was happy with it. In fact, although many chapters in the Life Divine were subsequently touched up, revised, had a sentence here or there added, sometimes six pages, sometimes more, new chapters written, this first chapter, he never touched it. He thought it was fine as it stood, and it really is a great declaration. It's a manifesto. So I pause and see if you have any questions this evening.